Thank you so much, Rev Lau, for coming.
I enjoy coming this day. So I'm not going to waste your time with an introduction. I'll probably introduce myself to every person anyway, so it's really not necessary. The shiur tonight is a little bit different than the usual. What I would like to do is compare two approaches by prominent rabban whose names you should be familiar with the questions of level of cooperation that the Orthodox community should have with non-Orthodox Jews. Even though on the surface they both come to the same conclusions, they do so from very different perspectives, which eventually make a difference. Even if you come to the same conclusions, you come from different angles with changes of circumstances, there'll be differences. In the last 150 years, there has been, unfortunately, a decrease in the percentage of Jews who were Shomrei Torah and Mitzvahs, who were Orthodox. And the question arises, to what degree should we interact, cooperate with those Jews who are either secular, conservative, reform, who don't share the same religious values that we have. This played a major role in two countries in particular. One is Israel, prior to its establishment as well. So with the emergence of the Zionist movement, we'll start with Herzl, even though there are earlier figures. In the late 1890s, the Zionist movement as a movement, which Herzl's basically responsible for, was dominated by non-observant people. In fact, many of the early Zionists were not only non-religious, they had broken away from observance, and many were antagonistic. This caused a split amongst the Orthodox rabbinate, with the majority of rabbis saying we cannot function within this framework. Non-religious, if anything, it's trying to redefine Judaism in nationalistic rather than religious terms. We have nothing in common. Famous for his working with the non-religious was Rav Kook. Rav Kook, Zechariah Livracha, came to Israel to become the chief rabbi of Yafo in 1905, eventually became the first chief rabbi of the then Palestine, because there was no state of Israel, passing away in 1935. And one of the areas in which he was considered controversial was the degree to which he worked with, cooperated with, spoke to, related to the Chavrutim who were not religious. And many other Rabbanim said, it's your responsibility as a Rav to give them Musar. They don't keep mitzvahs. Why are you spending your time with them? On the other side of the ocean, or in this case, the people in this room on this side of the ocean, in the United States, again, the majority of Jews were not Shomrei Mitzvahs, not observant. And the question came up, what degree should those Jews who are Shomrei Mitzvahs, Orthodox, work with these other elements who are taking much of the youth away from us. And a figure who presented a model for what level of cooperation and what level of differentiation with Rav Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and I'm going to compare the approaches of both of them using their written word, not my understanding, but what's found in the text. I'll start with Rav Soloveitchik, even though I mentioned Rav Cook first, because his mentality is going to be easier to deal with. Rav Cook is going to introduce the mystical component, that's going to be a little bit harder to handle. In 1955 or 6, I should remember, the Rav gave a talk that was later printed called Kol Dodi Dofek, which is a famous talk. Kol Dodi Dofek, the talk was given in Yiddish, was printed in Hebrew, and hasn't translated into English. There's actually two different English translations, in which he discusses our response to the Holocaust, the unanswerable question of how Kadosh Baruch Hu allowed 6 million Jews to be killed, and as well, since this is, remember, 1956, it's 8 years after the state was established, our response to the state of Israel as well. And it's a very long, it's a short book, long article, short book. Within it, at one point, he tries to give a basis for how to interact with non-observant Jews. And he discusses and then starts with chapter 6 of the book, and I'm going to discuss chapter 6, 7, and 8. And in chapter 6, he posits the existence of two different covenants, two different britot between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Klal Yisrael. One he refers to as Bris Mitzrayim, covenant of Egypt, also called Brit Goral, the covenant of fate, and the second is Brit Sinai, the covenant of Har Sinai, which is also called the Brit Yehud, the covenant of destiny. And in the Brit that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created with Klal Yisrael by taking them out of Mitzrayim, this essentially was done for the Jews by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Obviously, we didn't like being slaves, but it's not a response. We don't make any necessary commitment. We just accept Hashem taking us out. And the Rav sees that in terms of the Jews sharing a common fate. The Egyptians did not differentiate amongst the Jews who were Mitzrayim, who were observant, who were not observant, who were this Shevet or that Shevet. The Egyptians treated all Jews equally bad. And the Rav develops the notion that this covenant of fate has four elements to it, all very much related, starting with a shared fate means a shared experiences. We share a common fate, we experience the same thing. Right? The Jew is, sort of Jewish whether he picks to be Jewish or not. Jew cannot escape the presence of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, he cannot escape his identity. And of course, if you see this in the context that the Rebbe is speaking, a mere decade after the end of the Second World War, and the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, certainly did not differentiate amongst Jews, even those Jews who converted out didn't help them in terms of the Nazis. You're a Jew, that's it. But it's not only that we share a common fate, but it affects us. Right? Because if we share a common historic experiences, then we share in the suffering that all of us have. Part of being a Jew, unfortunately, has included a lot of anti-Semitism, and we respond very much as a group. For example, in our tefillos, when we pray, if you look at the Amida, all the supplications, all the bakoshos, are always with Hashem Rabbi, right? We don't say, Rufa'eni, heal me, it's Rufa'enu, heal all of us. We share, we pray together, we suffer together, we experience things together. Right? He has an interesting mashal, he quotes a darshan, he doesn't say the name, he wants to know that he compared the Am Yisrael to a man who had two heads. And the question was, if a person has two heads, is it one person or two people? Conjoined twins. Right? One person or two. So he said, well, if you take hot water and pour it over the head of one of the two heads, if the other head, if the other person calls out with the pain, shares the pain, then it's obviously one. If the other one doesn't experience any of the pain, then they're actually two. And it talks about the Klal Yisrael, we share in the pain. And that unites us. And it creates obligations, responsibilities from being part of the group. Right? The Jews always care about each other. They get blamed for each other. Right? If some Jew does something, the world blames the Jews, not an individual. We seem to share all these things together. And finally, this notion of a common fate creates a need to cooperate, which is usually reflected in Tzedakah and Chesed. Right? The Jews are very charitable people. We support all kinds of other Jewish institutions, and we pride ourselves in being Balei Chesed, right? Caring about others, having empathy for others. Now, what does this do for what I started out with? Well, it says that all the Jews who share this common faith, this common identity, care about each other and support each other, have all this in common, right? So it means there's a whole dimension of life in which the fact that some of us are shomer mitzvos and others are not is not really relevant, right? This concern for the welfare of the Jewish people is common to all of us. So it's certainly an area in which we can and should work together, because we do share this common faith. We're going to suffer if some Jew does something that people don't like, and we have to work together and support each other. However, the second dimension, which he calls the Brit of Sinai, of destiny, is something that we choose. Right? The Jews responded Naseh v'Nishma. It wasn't just Hashem with all the Kofa Mahaka. There's an element of acceptance of the Torah. And that creates a whole sense of relationship, the Kaddish Baruch Hu, and has to do with the whole life of observance that we're so familiar with. Right? So the Rabbi gives an example Chapter 8, between a camp and a congregation. A encampment is something that you do to fight, you get in the camp because you have external enemies, right? You unite to protect yourself from the enemy. A congregation have a common goal. It means we share a vision. So with this structure of a double brit, then the Rav says, in effect, we have a basis for defining the parameters of our relating with those Jews who don't share our vision. Because it's not just a single definition, it's a dual definition. Yes, there are many Jews who don't share our visions, and therefore we can't share with them our life of Torah mitzvahs if they're not interested in it. But anything that involves dangers to the Jewish people, right, we can work together. So anything that's threatening to Jews or harmful, it doesn't have to be only physically threatening. So on this basis, the many aspects of the Orthodox community work together with the non-Orthodox. And it works both ways. You know, there were issues that were more important for observant Jews than non-observant Jews, such as questions of the five-day work week. Before America had a five-day work week, Shmir Shabbos was extremely difficult. Because if it's going to be 6 days, it's going to be Sunday, so it's not Shabbos. Getting, when there were threats to Shechita, we were able to work together even with those who don't necessarily eat kosher food, because that was a threat to Jewish life. When it came to religious issues, of course, then we differed. And the same thing which existed in America obviously can be transferred to Israel as well. Right? All threats to the Jewish people in Israel are common threats that we all work together. When it comes to religious life, there we go our own way. So the advantages of this is it's a model that can be applied in different societies in different times. Right? It's not dependent on anything unique to a particular community and a particular situation, but it reflects a duality that exists in Jewish life. Right? All Jews share a common fate. Not all Jews share a common destiny. That's the Rav's model. Rav Kook's model is a very different one, and it's very much dominated by how he understood what was called the Yeshuv HaChadash, the new community of the Chalutzim in Israel, who on the surface, certainly, most of them, there were religious ones, but most of them were not only non-observant, but had rebelled against religion. And Rav Kook was criticized for his closeness to them. So, he's supposed to be a rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi. Why is he associating with these people? So in different places in the Igros of the Ariyah, which are letters of Rav Kook that were saved and put together in a series of volumes, he responds to the criticisms. So I'm going to quote two different approaches that he uses that are certainly not contradictory, but a little bit different. One is reasoning through historical analogy. So Rav Kook says, let's look at the time of Ezra HaSofer. Let's read Ezra and Nehemiah. Now, this one we don't tend to learn in most Tanakh classes.
Sorry, where did you say you were getting this from?
Igros HaRiyah, his letters.
Thank you.
All right. Let's look at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. Let's look at the beginning of Bayis Sheni, right? Of the rebuilding of the temple. We learned from Sifrei Ezra and Nehemiah and other sources that the large majority of Jews did not return from Babel to Eretz Israel. It was a minority. But not only was it a minority, but it was a minority that did not normally in general, reflect the highest level of religious observance of people. Ezra talks about problems of Chil Shabbos, giving Shabbos, and even more serious, if one can imagine more serious than Chil Shabbos, he talks about intermarriage problem, of trying to get people to leave their non-Jewish wives. And non-Jewish wives is the, if you could talk about a worse part of intermarriage, because if the mothers are going to be non-Jewish, so the children are going to be non-Jewish. So it's not it's intermarriage producing non-Jewish children in Israel. He says, this is what Ezra and Nehemiah had to work with, and yet the second Beis HaMikdash was built, yet the second Beis HaMikdash is the time of the expansion of Torah Shebaal Peh. We have very little information in Tanakh about Torah Shebaal Peh, but we know in Bayis She'eni it really expanded. And apparently that even though it wasn't the highest level Jews, the most religiously committed Jews, look what happened, right? Because they came. Similarly, if that was true in the building of Bayis She'eni, in the building, and now when they're returning to Eretz Yisrael, which is, there's a hint that Rav Kook doesn't mention in this play, we're nearing the time of Mashiach, this is going to be the final return. So even if the people who are returning are not observant, we have reason to expect wonderful things. The exposure, and he quotes two things are going to help. One is that the exposure to Eretz Yisrael, the love of Israel by itself will have a positive impact, and hopefully there will be Rabbanim who deal with them sympathetically, not critically, show them love and affection that will bring them closer, and bring out the spark of Kedushas Yisrael that's hidden. And here he's beginning to quote a notion which is found in other places in Hasidic literature, what they say in Yiddish, the Pintala Yid, right? That every Jew has within him a spark, a little point of Jewishness. And clearly, if these people are coming to build Eretz Yisrael, they must have this spark within them. So let's ignore what they're doing on the surface, and with proper love and reaching out, we will bring that spark into life and they'll do true. That's the first answer of Kook gives. In a different place, Rav Kook discusses it in a more theological context, using Kabbalistic sources, a lot of quotes from the Maharal and from Tikkuni Zohar, sources that Rav Soloveitchik was not likely to use. Huh? And he says the following. He says there are two sources for Kedushas Yisrael, for the sanctity of the Jewish people. One source is that which is inbred within them because they stem from Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov, an intrinsic Kedusha that every Jew has. You know that Rav Kook, following in the Kuzari, in the Maharal, sees the Jew as the highest order of creation. The Medievalists had four levels. Domem, Tzomeach, Chai, Adam. That which was, stones that didn't have any existence. Vegetation that grew. Animals and human beings. According to the Kuzari, there's five. After Adam, there's Yisrael, right? The Jew is a higher order of creation. Rav Kook has the same mystical notion. The Jew, and there's an intrinsic kedusha that every Jew has. And that you can see even Sefer Dvarim, when Moshe Rabbeinu says to the Jewish people, I'm not picking you because you're better than everybody else. Don't think it's a custom because you're so wonderful. It's because the merit of your forefathers, right? It's not your merit, it's merit. V'yisimli skula mikol ha'amim. Skula, which is a term often used for charms, you know, guaranteed good results. It's not something earned. You don't earn a skula, right? It's within you. So every Jew has within him that, again, the Pinto is, but this is even broader. The ethnic Lushis Yisrael that you're born with, because you stem from the Avos, and even when the Gemara says Zuchus Avos, you stem the Bris Avos still remains. You've got it within you, every Jew has within you. But then there's a second source of Lushis Yisrael, and that one achieves through Bechira, through choice, through what I do. It's not just intrinsic. I'm born Jewish, and then what I do with it? Do I keep mitzvahs? Do I do good deeds? Or do I just rely on the fact I'm have a proper birth? So there's an element, obviously, of bechira. This is often used in discussion of Korach, right? Korach's complaint, Korach kulam kedoshim. Right? All the Jews are holy. That's true on one level, but on the other hand, what do they do with it? It's a potential. Now, Rav Kook says, again, it's based on Hasidic sources, which Kedusha is the greater one of the two? So, some of us who see ourselves as rationalists, and we think of, how would the Rambam answer that question? Well, the Rambam would obviously say, Bechira is the one that counts, right? The essence of religious life is that we have a choice to make, and we choose to behave in a certain way, not because we're just born that way. After all, there's even a great religious problem if you don't have any notion of free will. The problem of how reward and punishment doesn't make any sense unless you assume free will. Right? I can't be rewarded or punished for what I do if I didn't have a choice. Because I chose to do something, that means I chose to do something that should be rewarded, or chas v'shalom, I chose something that should be punished. But if I did it because I was forced to do it, there's no place for God to reward me or punish me. I had no choice anyway. Right? However, in his thought, he assumes that the kedusha that is ingrained is the greater kedusha. However, one needs the Bechira to bring it out. In other words, the ultimate, more serious kedusha, that's what's within us, automatically, but we need choice, our behavior, to somehow bring it out. However, based on the Tikkuni Zohar, he says that we can look at it, you know, I'm using words that he doesn't use, Rav Kook never used. If you ever took a sociology course, a reverse bell curve. Okay? The bell curve is big in the middle, right? It's like a bell. I guess that's why it's called a bell curve. What's a reverse bell curve? It goes down and comes up at the ends, right? So he says you start off as your closest to Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov. You have the most impact from your birth, right? Because you're genetically closer to your sources. With the passage of time, that goes down. However, the ikvus of the Mashiach, as we get close to the Messianic era, we go back up again. Then, why is that true? Because Kabbalistic sources says it's true. I can't explain it any other way. All right. But clearly, the return to Eretz Yisrael, the Zionist enterprise, reflects the beginning of the return to the coming of the Mashiach. Rav Kook here is still using the traditional term of ikvaser de Mashiach, when the part waiting for Mashiach to come. What we're more familiar with is the later term that was used, reishis smichas geula, saying it was the beginning of the redemption. At a time of the beginning of the redemption, when Mashiach is coming, the intrinsic nature of the Jew becomes more and more important as we approach the Imos HaMashiach. And if that's the case, so then the fact that some people didn't make the right choices about how many mitzvahs to keep somehow is less significant, right? Because we're approaching the time of the redemption. All you need in order to for it to work is to identify, right? You have to identify with this Kedushas Yisrael that's intrinsic, and by coming to Israel and building up the land, of course you're identifying the Jewish people. What could be greater identification of one's Jewishness is to go back to Israel and to rebuild the land, return to our source, to our beginning. So that identification is sufficient. Right? You don't need the chira, the mitzvahs become less significant. Right? And then he brings an image which has turned out to be very controversial later. He gives the following image. Very interesting analogy. The Gemara says that the Mashiach is going to come on a donkey, right? So we ask, why the donkey? Right? Come on a horse, go faster. Why a donkey? He says something strange about the donkey. There are kosher animals, right? Try to eat. There are two simani kashras, two different things the animal has to have. Right? Jewish cub and the bulls. And there are some animals that have one of the two, which isn't sufficient, like a camel or a pig. And there's some animals that have neither. The donkey is one of the animals that has no sign of kashras whatsoever. Right? You would think it's worse if there's no sign of kashras. But at the same time, we know that if someone owns a donkey and the donkey gives birth, there's kedushas b'chor. You have to redeem the donkey with a seh, with a kosher animal. So the donkey has some kedusha despite the fact that on the surface, all its signs, it doesn't have any signs, external signs of kedusha, right? It's not, it has neither the two signs of kashrus, yet there's something there, right? So that's the Chamorah Shel Moshiach, right? The Chamorah Shel Moshiach has no signs of kedusha on the outside, but there's something inside. So this combines what I call, referred to before, the Pintel Yid argument, with the argument of the intrinsic kedusha of people who identify even though their behavior doesn't show it. Right? Doesn't show it. And therefore, they're necessary for the coming of Mashiach. Right? Again, he says, and you need rabbis who are sympathetic, who understand them, who can reach out, that eventually, out of course, eventually they're all going to change. This is just a stage. Once they have this, they'll eventually do tshuva. And later, in other places, in the pupils of Rav Kook, you know, are fond of saying they think they're not religious. But their love for the Jewish people and the land of Israel, they really are. Right? On the surface, they're not. Deep inside, they really are religious. Why do I say that this became controversial? Because the image of the Chamorah Shel Mashiach, you know, if you step back and say, whoa, all right, the religious people are the Mashiach, and they're the donkey, right? Doesn't sound so good, right? We have another image of the donkey. We have the Yitzhak, Avram and Yitzhak at the Akedah, going to two servants, right? And they're told to stay there with the donkey, right? While Avram and Yitzhak go So there, for that imagery, Hamorosh and Mashiach only go so far, and he gets stopped along the way, and we go much further. It's controversial. Now, the difference between the perspective of Rav Kook and of Rav Soloveitchik is that Rav Kook's perspective is based on, one, it's being ikmus of the Mashiach, right? That we're approaching the Messianic era, and two, that it's a very much an Israeli argument, right? These Jews identify with the Jewish people by living in Israel, they're building the land. Now they're part of the process of building up to bring the Mashiach. While it is somewhat transferable to Jews elsewhere, it doesn't work quite as well, right? The whole essence of it is that you see the inside because they come, they're like the Jews who came up with Ezra, not those who stayed behind. Even though they came up with Ezra and they weren't observant in the ways we would like, but they came. And that's all the Torah, everything that came out of it. So his argument is much more an argument for then Palestine and now Israel than an argument for the Jews, say, in America or somewhere else. While the argument that the Rav used is an argument that doesn't depend on where you are, right? All Jews who identify in some levels share the Jewish faith are on that one level of brit, right? It has the first brit. On the other hand, Rav Kook's argument goes further, because Rav Kook's argument is based on the assumption that these Jews who identify and have come to Eretz Yisrael are ultimately going to go much further, right? That kedusha that's within them by identifying, which it comes back from their intrinsic Jewish nature, will blossom. The Rav doesn't talk about blossoming. The Rav talks about we can work with them even if they're not religious because they share a common faith. They have a common covenant for issues of threat to the Jewish people. Not that the Rav doesn't believe in tshuva, but it's not part of his argument. Right? But it is. On the other hand, Rav Kook's argument, and remember, Rav Kook passed away in 1935. Now, all of us have the most elementary notion of arithmetic, that's 80 years ago. It's a long time. Right? So the people now who speak the name of Rav Kook are often four generations, right? Rav Kook's son passed away in the 1980s, right? So there's still a few of his Talmidim, but most of them are Talmidim of the son of Rav Kook. So it's had a long time to develop. I can tell you, on the other hand, in terms of Talmidim of Soloveitchik, many are still alive, and they all have different recollections. So it's what happens with students. So of the students of Rav Kook, they really split very much on this. One element, many of them stress that intrinsic kedusha they have. This is the element that sees the state as holy, because it is a Jewish state. It doesn't matter who the government is, it doesn't matter what policy it is, it has. Having a Jewish state is part of the redemptive process. Holy, right? Intrinsic kedusha. Right? We're getting closer and closer. We're part of the messianic process. Another part, however, sees the secular Jews who were waiting, right? Rav Kook wrote this in the 19-teens, 100 years ago. They're all going to do tshuva. They haven't seen it yet, right? So some of them see it as the donkey left on the bottom of the hill, right? They were necessary in the first stage, but we've gone beyond them, and it lends itself in some versions to say, well, if those Jews who don't share our vision, those who want to return territory, those who are not part of the Messianic, not supportive of what we see as the Messianic process, well, maybe maybe they're not really part of this. Many students of Rav Kook say no. They're all part of the process, but there already is a group, going in the other direction. All right. My point in doing this, hopefully it is of some interest, is to point out a few things. Number one, that you can come to the same conclusion. If you come there from different arguments, it will make a difference somewhere along the way. Right? Even if at the moment you're coming to the same conclusion, if you're coming from different perspectives, there's no guarantee that it's going to remain exactly the same. Right? Because the perspectives that are different, when facing new situations, may come up with different notions, number one. Number two, we can see that from theologically, that we have sources who do things in a very rational, halachic way, and other sources that do things from a more mystical tradition, and these are different parts of what we are, right? We have our rational components and we have our mystical elements, belief, you know, judgments as to who favors what. It's not our place. Right? And interesting, it also should help, and that's my third point. I assume that most of you studied in Israel. And even though, unfortunately, the level of interaction between Israeli and American students in most of the schools in Israel is not great. So it's possible to have spent a year or more in Israel and somehow be in Israel and still only talk to Americans. Okay. We have boys uptown in Yeshiva who learned in Israel for 2 years and never picked up a single Hebrew word more than they knew when they got there because they went to Yeshiva with other Americans. They spoke to the Americans in English the whole time. The shulim were in English, except for the bus drivers. You know, no people. But even if you didn't interact that greatly, I think it's quite apparent, and one should have gotten a sense that there's a difference in mentality. Particularly in the religious Zionist community, and a lot of that reflects the fact that the Americans who are religious Zionists tend to come from under the influence of Rav Soloveitchik, whose commitment to Israel is very much because Israel reflects protection from a terrible fate, right? It's what protects us. Israel is an opportunity. That's another part of Kol Dodido faith, the six knocks, right? That Israel is an opportunity for more, but it's not intrinsically messianic. Right? While in Israel, the dominant drug, right? If I'm an American, I say the Rav, I mean Rav Soloveitchik. If I'm an Israeli, I say the Rav, I mean Rav Kook. If you're an American and an Israeli yeshiva, it can be very confusing, right? You know, some say, some mean one, some mean the other. But those who influence Rav Kook are coming from a much more mystical, messianic perspective. And often, while it can agree in some situations, the difference in perspective can come out in many different ways. As I said, since most of you went to schools where the Israelis and non-Israelis didn't intermingle very much, you may not have seen it, but it's there. It's there, and it's important to note that there are different perspectives, different ways of looking at things, which, you know, on one hand is very helpful because it broadens our perspective, on the other hand can cause an unfortunate amount of distance because people are coming to things from such different criteria for how to look at it. Not just a different conclusion, different ways of viewing reality, but it is what it is. I thank you for your patience and for your coming. I'm told it's still in midterms, so I wish you success in whatever is left of your midterms, and success in whatever you do as soon as you recuperate from your midterms. And thank you again for coming. And I'll answer any questions.
Thank you.